might think that someone like Shakyamuni Buddha would just continue to be living. How could someone like that just grow old and die? For us, from his great bodhicitta, he offered us his body living and offered us his body dying. And so today we honor his parinirvana. And if nirvana is peace, total coolness, parinirvana is like complete peace and coolness. Parinirvana. They say, under the Bodhi tree, Buddha realized nirvana when he saw the morning star. Nirvana with remainder, it's sometimes said. So is peace and coolness, freedom from the suffering of the mind contacting objects. And then he continued to live for another 40 years. 50, almost 50 years, trying to help people understand such a profound insight. And then entered parinirvana, or nirvana without remainder. You'd say the remainder is a body and mind. Under the Bodhi tree, nirvana with this remainder of this body and mind that he had the deal with for another 50 years. And just like we have parinirvana in the winter in the Zen tradition, we celebrate now. Having just returned a few weeks ago from Kushinagara, where Buddha entered parinirvana, I feel like I have a fresh feeling about that event. There's people, is a especially kind of quiet feeling in that town, maybe more respectful. It's not so, you know, Bodh Gaya is a kind of exuberant town, maybe just bigger, but more energetic, a lot happening. Kushinagar, not so much happening, and there's that feeling of like, this is where the Tathagata entered nirvana, and it's not so much that we celebrate his part in nirvana, but we memorialize and honor him and remember the Dharma of our original teacher. And the Sashin will soon enter parinirvana without remainder too. We have a little bit more. Like at the bottom of page 3. Thus, when a particle arouses the aspiration, when a dust mote, and again, it's literally when a particle arouses, one mind follows and arouses. It's just the hotsu in this case. Or when a particle is brought forth, when a particle is generated, one mind follows and is generated. Dogen continues to just play with this word hotsu, giving rise to arousing. And then, so not only bodhicitta is aroused, but a particle can be aroused, and one mind follows and is aroused. Maybe implying that, like, bodhicitta is kind of like a dust mote. When one mind follows and arouses, one emptiness follows and arouses. Or when one mind is aroused, one emptiness follows and is aroused. When you, whether learned or beyond learned, arouse, generate, when you are generated, you acquire the seed of one Buddha nature. Not so much I think needs to be said. This is just Dogen continuously playing with what it is to arouse or generate, give rise to, manifest anything. When you turn the four great elements and five skandhas and practice sincerely, you attain the way. When you turn grass, trees, tiles, and walls and practice sincerely, you attain the way. It's so because the four great elements and five skandhas, as well as grass, trees, tiles, and walls, practice together with you. They have the same nature. Actually, it says they have the same study, the same nature, the same mind and life, the same body and capacity as you. Capacity is that word ki, as in Zenki, like Zenki is the whole works or total function. So it's like they have the same function, the same dynamic function. And at turn, we could say it's like, you know, turning things and being turned by things, just interacting. Or we could take it as the turning around, turning all these elements and skandhas around back to the source of all of them, the empty nature of mind, the Dharmakaya that manifests as Sambhogakaya, expression of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and grass, tiles, and walls. Everything's practicing together, seems to be the point here. Inconceivably practicing together. This being so, many of those who come from the assembly of Buddha ancestors endeavor in the way, that's bendo, endeavor in the way of taking up grass and having the heart of trees. Or you could say, many of those who come from the assembly of Buddha ancestors wholeheartedly practice the way of taking up the grass and tree mind, or the mind of grass and trees, which is the mind of wood and stone, the non-discriminating mind. The non-discriminating mind. This is how it is with arousing the aspiration for enlightenment. Hongren, who would later become the fifth Chinese ancestor, was once a practitioner who planted pine trees. Linji, or in Japanese Rinzai, practiced planting pine and cedar trees on Mount Huangbo. And we have a story about that. Dogen's talking about tree planting as Hotsubo Daishin here. So Linji, who practiced with Huangbo, so Linji liked to plant pine trees around his teacher's temple, Huangbo, Mount Huangbo. And Huangbo said, "What's the use of planting so many trees in the deep mountains?" And Linji said, "Two reasons. First, to beautify the temple grounds. Second, as a signpost for later generations. And Huangbo, his teacher, said, "Under you, my lineage will flourish throughout the world," which, of course, it did throughout the world. Here, it's Linji's lineage is right here in America. Amazing. So that's the story. Kind of funny. So Linji says, "I plant pine trees to beautify the temple grounds, and as a signpost." For later generations. So, you could say these two sides of practice, just the conventional taking care of things, taking care of the garden, taking care of coming to Zazen, it's just, you know, it's because it's beautiful. You could look at like making offerings in this particular way that we just try to learn how to do, and we'll see if any of us can remember what to do in another hour. And you could say, why? What's the purpose of such an elaborate ceremony? One, to beautify the temple. It's a beautiful, I feel like it's a beautiful expression. And I think often when we do these ceremonies, they're a beautiful expression. And Zazen too. Why do we sit Zazen? It's just, isn't it beautiful to come to a hall like this and sit Zazen? And second, that's the kind of like very simple thing. It's beautiful. And as a signpost for future generations. So we sit Zazen to kind of set the example, to keep this beautiful thing alive, because we feel like there's some value here. Is it just to keep the beauty alive? Maybe. Maybe something more. And same with a ceremony like this that, you know, we learn out of from our teachers and these Zen manuals, and, you know, it's not very American style. I think this kind of a ceremony, very Japanese flavor. Really like Soto Zen, Japanese Soto Zen, like Soto Zen, we say the style of the house is intimate attention to detail. Menmitsu no kafu means the house wind, or the style of the school is intimate attention to detail in caring with each other and in making offerings and so on. It's also okay to make mistakes, but you know, we make an effort. And that's because that's the style of our house. Not only is it beautiful, but we want to pass it on to future generations. So we'll do it another year. Maybe this is the last year we do it like this. I kind of thought that last year. Especially if there's not many people, but there's maybe more people than sometimes here, so. It's a question for me. Is that part of our style that we need to continue to offer as a signpost? Time will tell in America what signposts we need to keep polished. And it reminds me when I hear that, I like this story of Linji. I don't know what to make of it, actually. I plant pine trees for these two reasons. Pine trees also in Japan have a symbol for like longevity. But it reminds me also of the Buddha, and maybe Linji was thinking about the story of the Buddha, I don't know. It said that, I think the story is kind of related to this topic of the Sesshin. The Buddha liked to practice out in the forest in awe-inspiring jungle thickets and places like that. We went to the cave where Buddha practiced austerities near Bodh Gaya, up a steep cliff. This cave, a little bit awe-inspiring. Maybe on a dark night when there isn't a temple built right next to the cave in the old days, and Buddha's out there alone with the wild animals. So he liked to practice in these kind of like frightening places, so he's talking about that. He's talking about it as the Buddha after he's free of all fear. And so the person who's talking to him asks him, well, now that you're the Buddha and you were doing that as a kind of like to cultivate your mind and to practice fearlessness. And the Buddha talks in the sutra about, I'm trying to practice with my, I was afraid in those places, and that's why I would go to them to like overcome my fear. And the questioner says, well, now that you're the Buddha and you don't need to like, you don't need to train your mind anymore, actually. You're done. You're one beyond learning, as they say. Ashiksha. We have this term in the old tradition of, there's such a stage called beyond learning. It means like, you understand the Dharma completely and there's nothing more. It's called Buddha. It's one beyond learning. And everyone else on the way to Buddhahood is like, sometimes called a learner or like a trainee. Even great bodhisattvas. So anyway, since the Buddha was done learning what he had to learn, this questioner said, well, why do you still like to go out and live in the forest and like that? Doesn't really make any sense to me anymore. You're not afraid of anything. It seems really uncomfortable, I would think. And the Buddha says, two reasons, just like Linji. One is because I love it. I love living out in the forest, which is a little bit similar to just to beautify the grounds. I think it's beautiful to live in the forest. I live there. And second, as an example for future generations. So it's kind of similar to Linji's two reasons. And I think it's nice. It's a nice way we think about our own practice. Because we think it's beautiful, that's maybe like, it's just an expression, pure natural expression. Does it benefit others or not? It's just beauty. We don't even make a distinction. Or we're not consciously trying to benefit others. And then there's this other reason of like, no, we can consciously see that I think it's maybe good to set an example. The Buddha maybe thought, it's good for other people who are afraid of the wilderness to go practice there so that they can practice with their fear. It's good for people to come sit for 5 days and it's okay to experience some discomfort, and we get to really learn about our body and mind this way. So we'll sit here as an offering to everyone. I think if there's teachers who stop practicing, that becomes very questionable, right? Even Shakyamuni Buddha. Supposedly that's what he did after his enlightenment. He mostly just sat zazen. And when people would come and ask him questions and so on, then he was willing to always interact, and he'd sometimes walk around too. But I think not just living in the forest, but I think practicing zazen for the Buddha because he loved it, it was beautiful, and it's a good example. So this maybe both of these are bodhicitta. To do something because it's beautiful, and to set an example for others is maybe fabricated practice, but that's part of bodhicitta. I just do this simple thing because I think it might be beneficial. And old man Liu also planted pine trees on Mount Dung. This is not the Dongshan of our lineage, but another Dongshan, who also planted pine trees apparently, and maybe they both did. Old Man Lu and Dongshan were into planting pine trees, so Dongshan wrote a verse for his friend Old Lu because he appreciated him planting pine trees. The verse is, "Tall, tall, more than 3 feet, dense, dense, covered with weeds. Who knows what generation will see these pine trees grow old?" Maybe those pine trees were already very tall, 3 foot pine trees when he wrote this verse, but that we know they're going to last a long time and get very tall, and who knows what generation in the future will see them. Similar kind of spirit. Plant something really long lasting. Like Dogen Zenji. How much effort did he put into writing the Shobogenzo? And it's a little dusty, but it's still here, 800 years later. These practitioners took up the purity, or another translation is, took up the discipline of pine and cypress and plucked out an eyeball of Buddha ancestors, which is one of that's kind of a stock Zen phrase amongst all the very weird stock Zen phrases, is plucking out an eyeball of the Buddhas and ancestors.
And what does that mean?
Well, according to one interpretation, it's like getting the point of Zen.
Plucking the eye, getting the point.
Plucking out the eyeball of the Buddhas and ancestors. You could say it's like getting their eye, pulling out their eye. I now have the eye, the eyeball of the Buddhas and ancestors. I got it. Would we have come up with such a phrase? Maybe not, but you got to admit these guys are creative. Yes. The whole universe is the eye of a monk, yeah. And then that eye of a monk, we pluck out the whole universe and see through it.
Be it.
Hotsubodai shin, plucking out the universe and being it. This actualizing power of fooling with, or this is actualizing the power of fooling with and opening the eyeball. Fooling with, or another translation, playing with. This is actualizing the power of playing with and opening the eye. And opening the eye here is kaigen, which the footnotes say almost always this phrase kaigen, opening the eye, refers to the ceremony, the kaigen ceremony of dotting the eyes of a Buddha image. So, since we've been talking a lot about Buddha images here, it wouldn't be at all surprising if Dogen's playing and fooling with this double meaning. So this plucking out the eyeballs of Buddha ancestors and becoming the universe is actualizing the power of playing and fooling with and opening the eye. You could say, is the eye of the universe that we pluck out and be, is that the same eye that we dot in a ceremony and say, one drop of ink makes a dragon in both places, over there and over here?
You're actually putting ink.
Well, you know, I think originally, when the statue is built, and I think that probably it was actually you actually put the black pupil in the eye, and I've seen maybe Tenshin Roshi has actually done it that way. Or it's already black and you actually touch it. But it seems like the modern style is, you know, since fine artists made these, and if you do the, with an eyeball, if you have it slightly off center, or slightly off, the whole face would look askew. So these days you don't actually like touch it. I mean, the so-called official Soto Zen Kaigen ceremony says you actually do, you grind fresh ink, you put the ink on the brush, but you don't actually touch it. So I think that's quite interesting. You go to all this trouble of making this ink that actually doesn't touch anything, but how perfect, right? This is the style of our practice. You go to a lot of effort to do something that's seemingly completely useless. So that's, we dot the I, and you know, it also plays with the idea that, do you actually have to physically touch something to enact it? Not necessarily. So you could say, with a wholehearted spirit of opening the eye of a carved image of a Buddha, you're actually like plucking out the eyes of the Buddhas and ancestors, and you're actualizing the whole universe through such a ceremony, any ceremony. But was, you know, we're talking about actualizing the whole universe, but this could be done by an eye-opening ceremony. Building a stupa and creating a Buddha image are fooling with an eyeball, tasting the aspiration and letting the aspiration be aroused. Without attaining the eyeball of building a stupa and so on, Buddha ancestors would not attain the way. Only after attaining the eyeball of creating a Buddha image, you become a Buddha and you become an ancestor. So maybe at this point in this essay, for those who've been listening to this kind of thing for 5 days now, this seems very natural that he would be talking like this. I mean, what else can we say, right? No commentary needed. Without attaining the eyeball of these conventional activities, one will not attain the way. To say building a stupa and so on, which will turn into dust, is not true merit, but on the other hand, to train to be beyond birth, or to practice the unborn, is a solid practice which cannot be defiled by dust, is not the Buddha's words. So, this idea of dust, you know, images of the Buddhas and stupas, because they're compounded phenomena, will eventually turn to dust. And in fact, this particular Buddha on this altar is getting near halfway to dust. Yeah. The very small sentient beings have nibbled out sections of his body. If you haven't seen this Buddha close up, take a look afterwards. You know, it's all worm eaten. Yeah.
And I just want to say, for those, maybe not everybody knows, Catherine Thanis, our recently deceased root teacher here for many of us, she went to San Francisco Zen Center and they let her look at a whole bunch of different Buddha images, and that was the one she selected to come and be here.
It's unique.
Yeah. You know, it's her.
Yeah. I when I see it, I have the feeling of like, as the body falls apart and everything is breaking down, Buddha just continues to serenely sit without moving a particle until it's like there's just a pile of dust on the altar. So which is related, right, to this section here, where to have this is a false idea, is to say building a stupa or a Buddha image like that, which will become dust, that's not really, there's no merit in that. So that's why we have this kind of turning into dust statue, to express the beautiful merit in something that's disintegrating. But some people would say building something that's going to just disintegrate is not real merit, but to actually train in the unborn to be beyond birth and death, That's a solid practice which cannot be defiled by dust. The dust, of, in this case, dust means like discriminating ideas. So it's again, it's kind of like people falling into the ultimate. Let's just realize that, you know, unborn nirvana that doesn't come and go and never, you know, will never change. That's the real practice. Impermanent changing things and making them and, you know, doing a ceremony that'll just, as soon as we make all this work to put, set it up and put it together, and then we just do it and then it's done and we take it all apart and, you know, is it worth all this effort to do something for such an impermanent little event? So these are not the, this would not be the Buddha's understanding to just enter the ultimate. If you say that a stupa will turn to dust, then what is beyond birth will also turn to dust. If what is beyond birth does not turn to dust, a stupa will not turn to dust. What is this place of dust? Do you call it purposely made or not? Or do you call it fabricated or not? So Dogen, I think this morning, had almost the same conversation, right? If you're going to say this practice of making Buddha images is fabricated, then the 37 elements of enlightenment are fabricated. And if the 37 elements of enlightenment are unfabricated, then making a Buddha image is unfabricated. He's saying let's not discriminate amongst different kinds of practices, that these are just like simple, folky kind of practices, and these are like profound, deep ones. Any practice is, has both sides, any practice is a compounded phenomena, and its true nature is unborn. It's, especially in the Zen school, I think it's nice that Dogen, maybe he keeps making the same point over and over, but it's really like, you could hear him saying, his understanding of Zen is not just to like sit zazen and drop off body and mind. And we do chant that, right? At noon. Without incense offering, bowing, chanting Buddha's name, repentance, or reading scriptures, just sit and drop off body and mind. So here's the other side. Sometimes, you know, I think you could say at the time of sitting, don't be thinking about these other things. Or you could say, at the time of doing these other things, do it with the mind and body dropping off in that spirit. And then you can do anything. And sometimes the thing to do is just sit and forget about these offerings. What is this place of dust that we're talking about? That would be instead of do you call it. What is this place of dust that we're talking about? Is it conditioned or unconditioned? A sutra, in fact, the Avatamsaka Sutra, the flower ornament sutra, says, upon first arousing the aspiration in birth and death, the bodhisattva wholeheartedly seeks enlightenment solidly without being swayed. The merit of this single intention is so deep and boundless that even in countless eons the Tathagata cannot fully explain it. Although there's many translations of this verse, does it ring a bell? Does anybody recognize? Well, there is that not even all the Buddhas in 10 directions can measure the merit of one person's zazen. There's another thing too. We don't chant it very often, but this in San Francisco Zen Center, we actually chant this verse on certain occasions. But it's a different translation, which I can't remember because we don't do it that often.
What's the context?
The context is priest ordination.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's these certain verses that are done during head shaving. You might recall that the whole assembly chants. There's like three or four different verses One of them I remember is, only the mind of a bodhisattva can cut through this drifting, wandering life and take the path of nirvana. This virtue cannot be defined. That one, you know, we don't do that ceremony just every few years or something, but those verses are very powerful. Everybody's chanting that while the teacher is shaving the new priest's last bits of hair in the middle of the zendo. And there's several verses, and this one comes from the Avatamsaka Sutra. And I think in our translation, I think it actually uses the word way-seeking mind. It's or it maybe even uses the term beginner's mind. This beginner's mind is something vast and wide. Not even a Buddha can define it. Something like that. We could look at this ceremony, but I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I think then that's actually, according to the records, that ceremony comes right from Dogen's, before Dogen's time probably, but Dogen used the same priest ordination ceremony with these same verses. And it's called in the ordination manual, each of these verses has a name, and this is called the way-seeking verse. There's another one that's called the Hoshin verse, the arousing the mind verse. They're all kind of about bodhicitta. So you can say this head shaving priest thing, the spirit of it is like bodhicitta. I'm doing this with the mind of awakening for all beings. They all have that sort of flavor. But this one is literally called way seeking the way verse. I thought it was interesting to see. It actually means seeking. So maybe this idea of way-seeking mind, that's I think a Suzuki Roshi term, maybe even comes from this verse, seeking the way verse. Upon first arousing the aspiration, or again, literally, upon first arousing the mind, Hoshin, in birth and death. So the bodhisattva gives rise to bodhicitta in the middle of samsaric birth and death life. It's not like they go to some really unchanging, peaceful place and then arouse bodhicitta. Right in the middle of this birth and death mess, one gives rise to this thought. The bodhisattva, upon this first thought, the bodhisattva wholeheartedly seeks bodhi, enlightenment, solidly or firmly without being swayed. The merit of this single intention or thought, it's that nen. The merit of the single thought is so deep and boundless that even in countless eons, the Tathagata cannot fully explain it. Be nice to find that in that sutra, like the context, but it's, I think, hard because that sutra is very long. Clearly know that taking up birth and death to arouse the aspiration is wholeheartedly seeks enlightenment. So, taking up this mess we're in called birth and death, taking this life up, this birth and death, impermanent life, to arouse the aspiration is wholeheartedly seeks enlightenment. This single intention should be the same as one blade of grass and one tree. They are one birth and one death. The merit of the single intention is deep without boundary, vast without boundary. Even if the Tathagata tries to comprehend it using countless eons as words, it cannot be fully exhausted. That's just one of those inconceivable images. You're using countless eons as the words. Maybe in one eon, there's like, billions and billions and billions of words recited by all beings in that eon. You can say, taking all those words collected from a whole eon and trying to comprehend the merit of this single intention cannot be exhausted. It's inexhaustible, just as the bottom remains when the ocean dries up, or the heart remains after a person dies. So you can say, well, let's have everything, you know, let's have this whole ocean, everything here disappear by evaporating the ocean. And like, oh, but there's still this, now there's this huge bottom of the ocean left. It's like, it's inexhaustible. The heart after a person dies. So, this single intention. So here I think we really are talking about aspiration or intention, a thought, a wish, a vow. Just this one little thought. You know, nen jujin gi. Literally means like, it's like a thought moment. It's like a fleeting moment of thought is nen. And so this one little nen is the merit is inconceivable, because just like that bodhisattva in ancient times offered a bowl of soup to this Buddha in his realm named Shakyamuni and said, like, I just want to practice like Shakyamuni Buddha, helping beings and being so free and compassionate. May the merit of this soup offering be directed towards this aspiration. And many eons later, it came to fruition, and he was manifest as Shakyamuni Buddha. With the same name as that ancient Buddha, Shakyamuni. So the smallest little thought, the slightest movement in this direction can, you know, just start a snowball rolling endlessly, building up momentum. But it starts, you know, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with one step. So this is like, that's the first aspiration is... then the bodhisattva cannot be turned away. Just as the single intention is deep and boundless, one blade of grass, one tree, one stone, or one tile is deep and boundless. If a blade of grass or a stone is 7 or 8 feet, the single intention is 7 or 8 feet. Arousing the aspiration is also 7 or 8 feet. So then we have the relative and the ultimate, this boundless deep aspiration, boundless deep stones and trees, and then is there this boundless deep aspiration can also be spoken of as just simply 7 or 8 feet. Anyway, it's like very ordinary. And he's, why 7 or 8 feet? So of course, it comes from a Zen story. Which is also kind of related to this topic, probably not coincidentally. Shui Feng and Xuan Sha were practicing together. Shui Feng, they were walking along, Shui Feng pointed at the ground and said, this place would be good to build a seamless stupa. This place would be good to build, to construct, to fabricate a seamless stupa. Isn't it interesting? It's a story about building stupas, but Dogen doesn't actually quote the story in here. He just refers to it tangentially. Somehow Dogen, like, he does, maybe he was doing it just for us to, like, discover these things later and be like, wow, how did Dogen think like this?
Probably in the time, though, because the language was known to all these people that were scholars, kind of like poets.
So when they said 7 or 8 feet, they're like, that's the story about constructing a stupa, which you'll see. So Shui Feng pointed to the ground, this place would be good to build a seamless stupa, which is maybe a play here too, because seamless is like, you know, without, beyond discrimination, right? Like seamless, boundaryless stupa. But they actually call, as I understand it, the sort of most common monument stupa style for Zen ancestors now, it's like this, it's like basically an egg-shaped stone, kind of like egg-shaped. It's just really round, and then the name of the person's carved in it. There's different styles, shapes of stones, but a very common one is egg-shaped. So it literally, it doesn't have layers. You know, some stupas are like, have all these layers, and but a seamless stupa is just like a round sphere, and maybe meant to represent like the Dharmakaya with no edges. So even in modern times, they're called seamless stupas, but maybe and that those, or maybe they're named after this story, or maybe at that time they were like that too. But it's like a play with about what seamless means. So this place would be good to build a seamless stupa. And Chuanzhou said, "Oh, how tall should it be?" And Shuifeng just looked up and down. And Chuanzhou said, "It's not that the Reverend Yu lack the fortunate birth among humans and devas, but you have not even seen, even in a dream, the transmission of the true Dharma eye on Vulture Peak." That's how these Zen guys kind of like spar with each other. Instead of saying like, "I don't like your answer." Instead he says, "It's not that the Reverend lacks the fortunate birth among humans and devas, but he has not even seen, even in a dream, the transmission of the true Dharma eye on Vulture Peak," which is like the Zen lineage.
Dream on. Oh, sure.
Yeah, it's a very like elegant way of saying dream on. Yeah, exactly. Shui Feng says, "Oh, well, how about you?" That's always a good thing to say. Instead of like, "How dare you?" Or like, "That's sweet, but like, okay, you don't like my answer? What would you say?" Xuanzha said, 7 or 8 feet. We're talking about how tall. So this is this place would be good to build a seamless stupa. How tall should it be? Well, that's kind of like dream on. But what would you say? 7 or 8 feet. Yeah. That's how tall it should be. So it's again a Zen story about someone seeming to go too far into the ultimate by just going, it's too ultimate. How tall should it be? 7 or 8 feet. Exactly. Get out your yardstick and start building a stupa. So it's the concrete, right? The concrete, specific. How tall should this seamless, boundless monument be? We might say, the size of the entire universe and beyond. No, I disagree. I think it should be 7 or 8 feet. A lot of Zen stories are like this, right? They take something very like vast and inconceivable and make it very concrete. You know, what's the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? A cypress tree in the garden, or a pile of dried turd. You know, these are like the standard Zen answers for the most vast question of, you know, what's the purpose of Zen? This pile of dried turd. Right here, now, this simple. So, Dogen's saying, this single intention of bodhisattvas is deep and boundless. One blade of grass, one tree, one stone, one tile is deep and boundless. If a blade of grass or stone is 7 or 8 feet, the single intention of bodhisattvas that's boundless is actually 7 or 8 feet. Arousing the aspiration is also 7 or 8 feet. In other words, like, this mind, arousing the mind of awakening is inconceivable. And it's like, I'm planting these pine trees for two reasons. Two. What? You're enumerating the reasons for, you're discriminating about bodhicitta? Yes, I'm willing to. Thus, going deeply into a mountain and contemplating the Buddha way is easy. Building a stupa and creating a Buddha image is very difficult. Both types of practice require endeavor without slack, but the practice to take up mind contemplation and the practice taken up by the mind, building a stupa and so on, are far apart from each other. We could say the practice to use mind and the practice to be used by the mind are far apart from each other. And then the translators here are putting these parentheses to, that's, this is their interpretation. The practice to take up the mind is going into the mountains and contemplating or intending to become a Buddha. And the practice taken up by the mind, or the practice of being used by the mind, is building a stupa and so on. Which is a little bit like the spirit of when the myriad things come forth and confirm the self is awakening, but carrying the self forward and confirming the myriad things is delusion. So like, I'm going into the mountains and attain the way now. Don't stop me. It could be, maybe Dogen's saying, in this case, he's saying, that could be like carrying yourself forward, but like, I'll just build a stupa. And everyone says, you should go into the mountains and practice the way. Why should you, how are you going to realize the way by building a stupa or cooking a soup or mowing the lawn or taking care of your grandchild? And you say, but that's letting the myriad things come forth and use us. Being used by the mind rather than using the mind. These are far apart from each other. In this way, arousing the aspiration for enlightenment accumulates, actualizing Buddha ancestors. This was presented to the assembly at Yoshimine Temple, also called Kipoji, in Yoshida County, Echizen Province, at the bottom of the mountain where Eheiji was about to be constructed by a group of construction workers 5 days later. They were already gathering wood, stones, and pebbles to construct a temple, a stupa, and a Buddha image in just a few days afterwards, we know from the date. On the 14th day, the second month, today is the 16th day of the second month. Usually Pari Nirvana Day is celebrated on usually the 15th day. Okay. We're actually 2 days late.
Their year doesn't start when
today's the 17th. What?
Does their year start when our year? I mean, the Japanese.
No, this would be like probably lunar. But that's why they say, they don't say February. The 14th day of the second lunar month. So it's a slightly different time of year. Uh-huh. But these ceremonies, like Pari Nirvana is the 15th day of the second month, was used to be the lunar month, but modern Japan, they go to the Gregorian calendar. Mm-hmm. So actually February, they actually do 15th now, they would do in Japan. So because of the Sesshin schedule, we're a couple of days later. But I didn't notice that till right now, mm-hmm. that this was given the day before Pari Nirvana Day. Mm-hmm. How interesting.
Mm-hmm. It is.
In 1244, where they probably, since ancient times, they've had the image, the painted or constructed image of a reclining Buddha lying on his right side between twin sala trees in the Kushinagara grove under the full moon, all serene and quiet, about to enter Parinirvana. We were in Kushinagara on the full moon, actually, and we did our Bodhisattva precept ceremony with our pilgrimage group at the Kushinagara stupa, as I bowed to the Kushinagara stupa, Buddha finally dropped off the last traces of body and mind. I put some sala tree leaves from the Kushinagara sala tree grove on the altar under the Buddha's image. Arousing the aspiration for the unsurpassable, generating the supreme mind, so ordinary, so holy, not so ordinary, not so holy.
You're saying it's ordinary, I'm just saying it's grass, trees. They all do it.
They all do it. Birds do it, and bees do it. Let's arouse the mind.
Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
Yeah, ordinary and completely inconceivable, boundless beyond our wildest dreams. Not even a Buddha. Not even a Buddha taking up all the words that have ever been spoken in countless eons could begin to talk about such a thing. So it's both and it's neither. And it's here always with us already, not something we have to create. And it's something that's waiting to be revealed and brought forth and celebrated. Any last points to bring up before the Buddha enters Parinirvana? He said, "Speak now, because this is your last chance." Yes.
It reminds me of 2 years ago, our trip to Koyasan in Japan, where there is this huge reclining Buddha in this huge stupa, and you see it, and then they let so many people, and we were lucky to be, you could walk underneath of it totally in the dark. And there's no light at all. You sort of grope your way down the hall, underneath the Buddha. That's the two sides right there.
The constructed image,
yes,
and the unconstructed darkness.
Yes.
Light and light, there is darkness, but don't take a hold of it like that.
Because I mean, it was so clear the form. It's a huge gold Buddha, I mean 80 or 90 feet long. And then you go underneath the same Buddha. There's Rolex down there, but you can't see him. Just have to take their word for it.
Yeah. Those are the best kind of relics, actually. Which reminds me, I'll just close with this. This is something that we, on our pilgrimage group, we chanted at all these places because it seemed quite appropriate to honoring Shakyamuni Buddha and the places that he went. And because it's the Soto Zen verse, and it's often chanted in Japan. We would chant this at Parinirvana Day. It's particularly connected with Parinirvana Day, and I didn't have time to make copies after thinking of this, but maybe sometime we chant. It's called the Shari Raimon. Anyone heard of Shari Raimon? It's like a short verse. Sometimes done other ceremonies too, but and I don't know if it's outside Soto Zen. It might be actually like post Dogen Zen. Oh yeah. But this verse.
Yes.
Yeah. So the sharira are the means relics, the relics of the Buddha. So this is a verse of homage to the Buddha's relics, or bowing. Rai means homage or prostration. So bowing, prostrating to the Buddha's relics, or homage to the Buddha's relics. And the verse is, with wholehearted reverence we bow to the one fully endowed with myriad virtues, Shakyamuni Tathagata, to the relics of his true body, the Dharma body, which is the fundamental ground, and to his stupa, which is the whole universe.
Wow.
With deep respect we venerate the one who manifested a body for our sake, which enters us as we enter it. Through the sustaining power of the Buddha, we verify awakening. By means of the Buddha's spiritual power, we benefit living beings, arouse the thought of awakening, cultivate bodhisattva practice, and together enter perfect peace, the knowledge of the equality of all things. Now let us reverently bow. We wholeheartedly bow to the Buddha's stupa, and we were always bowing to stupas on this India trip, but we hear that the Buddha's stupa is the whole universe. We just, you know, but this is giant fabricated thing in front of us, so we might as well bow to it too. Thank you all for your attention and bearing patiently with these long-winded Dharma talks. We've been sitting here a long time. Please take care. We dedicate any merit arising from this art gathering of Sesshin, you know, unfabricated merit or fabricated merit, conceivable or inconceivable, to all living beings in the universe. May they all find ease and joy through our positive intentions. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.